The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Oftentimes you'll find that around the world, like political advisors do travel and do work for people. I mean, I think they also keep a track. Like it's not just Zamora who knows, but like his political advisors are likely the type of people who are trained to know this is how we, you know, stay on message, that we make sure we're in the conversation, we're in the public debate, so that all of the attention is trained on us. And when he does that, it's not just ensuring that he's getting media attention, it's also ensuring that all the other potential candidates are then being put in the position where they have to respond to things he's said and done. And if that sounds familiar, that's because that was 2015 and 2016. That was Trump. And even if he wasn't necessarily taken seriously in the media, as I don't think Trump was, at least initially, he, you know, eventually was high up in the polls and continued to do well and ultimately came out as the candidate. I think the French press do take Zamora more seriously, but I don't think that that's necessarily translated into them covering him any differently.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 29th. 2021. There's a presidential election coming up in France in April of 2022. And in a surprise to many, in recent polls, the occupant of second place behind the incumbent president is a man who's never run for office before. His name is Éric Zemmour. He's a veteran journalist, a provocateur, and a virulent Islamophobe. I sat down with Yasmin Serhan, a staff writer at The Atlantic, to talk about Zemmour's rise. Who is he? How did he come to be so popular? Is he even going to run for president? What about all that's happened so far in France has shades of Donald Trump? It's a Lawfare podcast, October 29th. Who is Éric Zemmour?
So I think the best place to start might just be, who is this person?
That's a great question. Who is Éric Zemmour? So basically, Zemmour is a far-right pundit. He's a journalist, he's a television host, and he's been around in France for a while. This is not someone who's kind of just come onto the political scene, so to speak, an outsider that no one's heard of. You know, when I was doing my reporting for this piece, I was kind of reading back on coverage of him, and I found a profile of him in the New York Times in 2019, actually. So even then, he was kind of, you know, very much seen as this sort of kind of radical thinker, this political commentator. And he is, you know, in a lot of ways, very much of the French establishment. He was born to a Jewish family from Algeria. I don't want to say that they immigrated to France, so to speak, after the War of Independence in Algeria, because under the laws that were in place during the French this colonization of Algeria, all Jews in the country were granted French citizenship. So they simply moved. And he grew up in the suburbs of Paris. And he went to Sciences Po, which I think is, as many of your listeners will probably know, one of the training grounds of the French elite and of the political class. And after graduating from Sciences Po, he ended up becoming a journalist. And he's worked for mainstream establishments like Le Figaro, which is the country's center-right paper of record. But he's also worked for a slew of other outlets. CNews is a prominent one that comes up quite frequently. It's France's answer to Fox News. So yeah, he's a commentator, he's a writer, he's written biographies of former French presidents, he's written his own books. The French Suicide is probably one of his most prominent ones, but he's also promoting his most recent book, which is called France Has Not Yet Said Its Last Word. And what's actually funny, he did admit in an interview with the New York Times, a more recent one, that the cover of the book is basically him in front of a French flag looking all presidential. And he told the New York Times that he apparently modeled that after Trump's Great Again, which is a very similar cover of Trump in front of the American flag. Both books published ahead of major elections. So that's a bit about Zemmour. I mean, he's 63 years old. He's always been kind of a radical figure. And, you know, he has a lot of contentious views when it comes to kind of all the classic sort of populist things that we think of: immigration, Islam, certainly, even French history and kind of revisionist history, the how kind the Vichy government was to Jews during the Second World War, things like that. But this is, I think, you know, perhaps the first time that he's been seen as sort of a potential politician or kind of a viable contender to take on the establishment from the far right, which, you know, for a long time has been the space dominated by Marine Le Pen. So anyway, that's kind of a very long-winded way of saying that Zemmour is effectively a very familiar face in France, but he's becoming even more familiar now that people see him as a potential viable contender for the French presidency. And indeed, you're seeing in the international press, the reason we're talking about him right now is that people are learning more and more about him even beyond France.
And so has he declared his candidacy for president yet?
He has not. And it's unclear why. I mean, it's my understanding that one of the things that you need in order to declare your candidacy for the French presidency is 500 signatures from mayors across the country. It is not at all clear to me that he has those yet. No one I spoke to is under any illusions that he isn't going to declare his candidacy. And I would imagine if Marine Le Pen can get those signatures, then I can't imagine that Eric Zemmour would have any trouble on his end. But yeah, you know, I think he's created quite a lot of intrigue, the sort of, you know, will he, won't he, when will he declare his candidacy? In comments to the press, he's basically said that, you know, when I want to be a candidate, I'll say so. And until then, I'm just considering it. But if you watch the way he, you know, is going around the country, the way he's speaking to these, you know, big crowds, even the way he kind of just, yeah, like kind of promotes himself on Twitter, this is very much a man that looks like he's just priming himself for an election campaign.
And give us a sense of how popular he is. I took a look at the polling data, and I have to say I was very, very surprised at just how popular this guy is relative to the other candidates.
Yeah. So, I mean, the polling, especially recent polling in recent weeks, have shown him with a lot more support than I think we perhaps would have expected, certainly earlier this year. You know, I think it's worth mentioning just at the top that we're still 6 months away from a French election. Now, in a U.S. context, that's not a lot of time. But in a French context, and indeed, I think in most other countries, that is still a long ways away. I mean, this campaign, I should say, has really scarcely begun. But, you know, the polls are still very telling. Recent polls show Zemmour attracting anywhere between 16 and 17% of the vote. Now, on the grand scheme of things, that probably doesn't sound like a lot. But, you know, the French system is a little different from the American one in that typically, for starters, there are more parties, there are more candidates. And typically what happens is you'll have all these candidates compete against each other in the first round of voting. And after that vote, the number of candidates will whittle down to the top two, who will then go on to the runoff. I think what's significant about the fact that Zemmour is attracting anywhere between, say, 16, 17% of the vote is that in those polls that show him that high, he's second really only to Macron, who seems to be leading in the first round polling with 24 to 28%. Now, I don't want to kind of misrepresent Zemmour's popularity. In all the polls that I've seen so far, in a second round vote, Macron is seen to win handsomely against Zemmour. But I think it's still telling that, you know, this would be yet another presidential election in France where we see a candidate like Macron going up against a far-right candidate. Now, in the past, you know, as was the case with Marine Le Pen in 2017, she was soundly defeated in the second round, very much seen as kind of a repudiation of the far-right politics. You know, a lot of people I spoke to in France about this have always talked about how their system in this way has more protections against someone from the far-right emerging and getting power. And you know what, to a certain extent, that might very well be true. And I don't think anyone, at least at this stage, is really talking about Zemmour as though he were a president in waiting. I certainly don't think he's garnered that much support. And in a lot of ways, in fact, I think, you know, part of the concern that comes around all the coverage of him is that you would think, based on how many headlines there are, not just in the French press, but also in the international press, you would really think that Zemmour actually had a shot at this. And I think that the frustration that I certainly heard from some French journalists who are cognizant of the ways in which, you know, them and their colleagues are really sort of focusing on him is that, you know, he doesn't exactly represent the views of the majority in France, and yet he's being assigned the majority of the coverage, the majority of the attention. Relative to other potential candidates, of course.
Yeah, I want to unpack all of that. But first, one thing I'm curious about is who are the demographics of people that have been most inclined to support him? I know from the Le Pen experience, there are certain cohorts of people within the country who have a much higher tendency to support her and to support that party. Is the same thing sort of playing out with Zemmour, where there's a relatively consistent group of people who are his stalwarts?
That's a really good question. I think what we can say definitively is that Zemmour appears to be attracting the sort of traditional voters of Le Pen. You know, what we're seeing is that Zemmour clearly appears to be threatening the sort of traditional national, what was formerly known as the National Front, now the National Rally supporters, the supporters of Marine Le Pen's party. And I think part of that comes down to the fact that over the last few years, since the 2017 election, Marine Le Pen has been on this quest to detoxify both the brand of her party, but also her brand. You know, her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, was kind of notorious, the founder of the party, unapologetically far right, anti-immigrant, at times anti-Semitic, you know, just homophobic, like, you know, the list goes on. This is a man who had, I think, what you could probably describe kind of generally as very incendiary views. And I think Le Pen was very cognizant of the fact that if she were to get anywhere close to power, and if her party were to be taken seriously, that they would need to moderate the brand. I think this is why we saw the name change to the National Rally. And that's also why we've seen Marine Le Pen try to soften some of the party's more hardline rhetoric. She holds the same views vis-a-vis immigration, vis-a-vis European Union membership, all those things, but she will shy away from saying things that could be seen as a religious or racial provocation, at least in the eyes of the law. And I think the difference is that Zemmour does not. Zemmour is more than happy to kind of say what he thinks, even if it's kind of seen as hateful, denigrating Arabs, immigrants, Muslims. One of the things that I think has been touched on both in my piece, but I think in a lot of the pieces that we've seen emerge about him in recent weeks is that he is a proponent of the great replacement, kind of white nationalist conspiracy theory, this notion that, you know, the indigenous sort of white populations of Europe are actively being replaced by immigrants predominantly from North Africa and the Middle East. You know, basically, what I mean to say is that whereas Le Pen is trying to moderate her image, Zemmour is doing the opposite. And I think if you're a supporter of Le Pen who feels like she's going too far, or she's kind of, you know, sacrificing on the party's views and its values in order to be more widely accepted by the rest of the country, then Zemmour is potentially, you know, an attractive alternative.
Yeah, maybe flesh out a bit more. What are his hobby horses? You mentioned his sort of fixation with Islam in France, but I'm curious to have you talk a bit more about what are the things that he just keeps coming back to over and over again?
Yeah, I mean, he has quite a few of them. I mean, I think one that was raised quite a lot in recent weeks because it sort of became a news item of its own was his insistence that France should ban foreign names, for example, like Muhammad. But he doesn't just stick to Arab names. He also said, you know, kind of foreign or Anglo names like Jordan or Kevin should also be banned. And he believes that basically there should be a list of sort of French Christian names. And this has been a hobby horse of his for a while, actually. You know, it was covered as though it were a recent thing. And I'm sure he's kind of made it an issue on his, say, quote unquote, campaign, because he, as we've established, hasn't formally announced his candidacy. But, you know, looking back, this has actually been an issue of his for a while now. You know, I found stories about how he had basically called out a government minister and criticized the choice of her daughter's name because it wasn't considered a French name. He's called out his fellow journalists, colleagues, one who I believe had a Senegalese name, and basically told her that her name was an insult to France. So he's very much committed to this notion of being proud to be French and being of French culture and to protect that, and effectively not to have anyone in the country who would be seen as sort of a challenge to that. And I think that's kind of part of the reason that he is also a vocal opponent of immigration. You know, he's opposed to this notion of immigrants arriving to the country and not being fully French. And also, I mean, of course, another issue is laïcité or secularism in France, and this notion of, you know, what is appropriate when it comes to, you know, wearing religious symbols. This has always been a pretty hot button issue in France. I say hot button in France, but perhaps more from an international perspective. I think, especially coming from the US, it's probably hard to imagine that a country would sort of dictate what religious symbols you wear, be it a cross or a kippah or a hijab or a headscarf. But this is, you know, another issue, and it's long been an issue in France, but Zemmour very much appears to fall on sort of the side of these symbols should not be allowed. And indeed, he was filmed basically debating with a French Muslim woman who, you know, I think had, if I'm remembering the clip correctly, had basically dared him. She said, "I'll take off my hijab if you take off your tie." And he took it off and was basically goading her to do the same and implying that she wasn't free. So, I mean, in many ways, a lot of his hobby horses are a lot of kind of, you know, the sort of far right to right wing issues that have come up in France in the past, be it around French identity, French memory, immigration, Islam. I think he's also critical of kind of global institutions like the European Union and NATO. These are kind of other sort of classic far right populist talking points. But, you know, I think given the fact that he is able to sort of dominate or appears to be dominating at least the conversation in France with these issues at a time when we're, you know, facing a global pandemic still, when world leaders are about to gather in Glasgow to talk about climate change and you know, how to address the climate crisis, it really does feel like we're arguing or the French public are kind of being forced to reckon with issues that, you know, which isn't to say that they're not important. I mean, obviously issues like immigration are always going to be kind of, you know, I think hot button political issues, but I certainly don't necessarily think that they're the priority or certainly haven't been for the last year. So it's just interesting to me to see how he's managed to steer the conversation in such a way that, you know, you have France debating these issues that frankly they were probably debating in the last election.
Yeah. And so one of the premises of your piece in The Atlantic is he's doing these things, but he's also doing them in a way that maximizes the amount of attention he gets in a very sort of quasi-Trumpian way, right? He won't just say something, he'll say it in the most provocative, most public, most stunt-like way possible. Talk a bit about what his, you know, maybe implicit strategy is there and how that sort of inflected media coverage of what he's doing.
Yeah, I don't want to pretend to know what his strategy is. I did reach out to Zemmour's team for this piece, and unfortunately wasn't able to speak with him about this before publication. But yeah, I mean, all the signs kind of point to someone who is very media savvy and who knows how to basically keep the attention trained on him. And I don't think this is new. In fact, this was a line from that profile I mentioned that I found of him from a few years ago. It was basically something along the lines of, you know, this is a guy who knows how to ensure that everyone's talking about him all the time. And so I think Zemmour is well trained in this. And I think part of the reason comes from the fact that, you know, he was a journalist, a political commentator and journalist for many decades. So, you know, you would think that he would have come away from that career with, you know, an idea of how to maintain and attract press attention. And he has. And yeah, exactly as you said, you know, I think he knows how to say things that outrage. You know, I think if we've learned any lessons from Trump, and I'm sure Zemmour has learned them too, it's that you don't need to be the smartest person in the room. You don't have to have all the facts. You don't have to have the most convincing argument. You just have to be the one who says the most outrageous things in order to get attention. And why wouldn't you, right? Because you're someone who's running for the presidency. You're someone who's seen as this potential contender, but you're saying these incendiary things. And I think the impulse of journalists, and I think this was the case in the US too, is that, you know, that's newsworthy. That, like, you know, we, you know, it's kind of that sort of tired cliche of, like, you know, we don't cover the planes that land. You know, this is something that's out of the ordinary. It's unusual. So naturally, we're going to have our attention trained on that. And I think Zamora knows that. And that's why he, you know, attends an arms fair in Paris and points the rifle at journalists, however jokingly, and tells them to back off. You know, I don't think he does things like that without knowing that they're going to get a reaction. And it doesn't even necessarily need to be a good reaction. Certainly, the reaction to that clip, which was, I'm referencing something that I believe happened last week, that wasn't good. I mean, even a government minister, if I'm not mistaken, had basically tweeted out condemning him, you know, even in jest, sort of seemingly threatening journalists. And that was a great moment for him to basically clap back and quote tweet her and say that you don't have a sense of humor. I'm paraphrasing, but that was more or less the sentiment, this notion that, like, you're too uptight, you take things too seriously. And I mean, something that has come up in my reporting, and I something that I'm, you know, would be curious to know more about, because I don't know who's advising him, of course, but, you know, oftentimes you'll find that around the world, like, political advisors do travel and do work for people. I mean, I think they also keep a track. Like, it's not just Zamora who knows, but, like, his political advisors are likely the type of people who are trained to know, this is how we, you know, stay on message, that we make sure we're in the conversation, we're in the public debate, so that all of the attention is trained on us. And when he does that, it's not just ensuring that he's getting media attention, it's also ensuring that all the other potential candidates are then being put in the position where they have to respond to things he's said and done. And if that sounds familiar, that's because that was 2015 and 2016. That was Trump. And even if he wasn't necessarily taken seriously in the media, as I don't think Trump was, at least initially, he, you know, eventually was high up in the polls and continued to do well and ultimately came out as the candidate. I think the French press do take Zamora more seriously, but I don't think that that's necessarily translated into them covering him any differently.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me. And it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
Yeah, so do you have a sense that his game plan here is working, right? Is he succeeding in monopolizing the conversation, shifting its terms, getting as much attention, all that stuff?
I mean, we're talking about him, right? Yeah. Like, we're talking about him right now, and we're not in France. Obviously, his focus is France, but yeah, I think he is being successful. I mean, look, even if he doesn't declare his candidacy, and I don't think for a moment, and I say this purely because everyone I spoke to for this piece doesn't seem to doubt for a moment that he won't. You know, I think he has at the very least ensured that media and press attention is trained on him, that he is a present part of the public debate. And you know, even if that just means he sells more books, that he's succeeding in that. And, you know, these things are all interrelated. You know, I don't envy the French press, because I do think that they are faced with a pretty significant challenge. I mean, on the one hand, you have this pretty outlandish, like very loud, sort of radical potential candidate for your country's presidency, who is saying all sorts of things that's kind of demanding your attention. But on the other hand, if you don't cover him or you try to kind of ignore him, then are you failing in your journalistic duty to cover a viable contender for the presidency? And I say viable not because, you know, I have a crystal ball and I know that he's going to make it to the second round, but that's what the polls are telling us. Polls are suggesting to us that he's viable. And the reason that I say these are all interrelated, because I think that, you know, it all kind of, I think, works out in his favor, in the sense that, you know, journalists may look to the polls and be like, that's the reason we need to cover him, because he's so high in the polls. It would be a dereliction of our duty if we didn't. But by that same token, the more he's covered, the more he's discussed, the more he's present in the public debate, the more likely, I think at least, he's likely to be mentioned in polls. Because if you think 6 months out to any election, frankly, at this point in time, this is when the wider public are just learning about who these candidates are. Some of them may not know very much about Eric Zemmour or indeed Michel Barnier. I mean, we know him really well because he was the Brexit negotiator, but he hasn't had as high a profile in France. Anne Hidalgo, obviously being the mayor of Paris, she's kind of, you know, has name recognition. But frankly, when you're getting polled and asking, like, you know, who do you think is the candidate you're going to support? Who do you like? You're going to think of names you know. And I mean, in France, at least, a name that I think it's safe to say a lot of people know now because he's seemingly everywhere and an inescapable presence is Eric Zemmour.
You had some interesting details in the piece about the way, sort of the internal discussions in French press about how to handle him, right? Like we're talking about it here, but it seems like there's at least some conversation about how to deal with this. Talk a bit about that. What's your sense of how these papers are approaching and you know, newscasters in general are approaching this problem?
Yeah, I think there is some debate. I mean, I've come across some pieces in sort of the French media, particularly sort of media watchdogs about their coverage of Zemmour and, you know, how they approach it. I spoke to some journalists who have been tracking how many mentions Zemmour has gotten in the press and how much airtime he's gotten in the press. So I think there is an awareness, at least among these people who are interested in it, that he is getting a disproportionate level of coverage, not just as someone who hasn't declared his candidacy, but just more generally compared to some of those other names I mentioned, Anne Hidalgo, Michel Barnier, even indeed Le Pen. I spoke to this one independent journalist who's been tracking the broadcast times. And for the month of September, I think he estimated that Zemmour got around 11 hours. Le Pen got, I think, just over one. So that kind of tells you, you know, how much the interest and focus has shifted. As for what those conversations look like, I mean, I can only really speak from the conversations I've had, but, you know, I think a lot of it comes down to sort of trying to determine how do we cover someone who's not yet a candidate, but who we know is going to become a candidate, and sort of what responsibility do we have to pay attention to what he's saying and how much attention is too much attention. I'll turn back to the example about the names and the banning of foreign names in France. Some publications, both in France and internationally, covered that story widely. One senior editor for a French paper that I spoke with, and you know, just doing my own cursory research, there were a couple of others. Some of them didn't cover it. And the reason this particular editor told me they didn't cover it is because it wasn't new, because these are comments that he's expressed in the past. And to quote the editor, they were frankly ridiculous. They knew that this wasn't, at least from their, like what they gauged, not really a critical issue that they felt their readers needed to know. And I think, again, if you're thinking about this against the backdrop of the idea that we have 6 months left until the election, and that this is the time when the public are trying to learn about all the candidates and what they stand for, I think then, you know, journalists kind of need to assess, okay, what is our responsibility here? And, you know, what information do they need to know? Do we need to dedicate, like, you know, space and broadcast hours to an argument that he's made for years and that were widely covered at the time? So I think that's kind of the debate. But, you know, it's an ongoing debate. I think, and that's part of the reason I wanted to write this piece. I'm not in the French media, so I'm not inclined to kind of, you know, overly criticize. I'm cognizant that the U.S. press has made their own mistakes, some of which they haven't learned from, with regard to Trump and sort of more extreme politicians in Congress and elsewhere. But, you know, I'd hope that at least by starting this conversation now, or at least kind of helping start this conversation, then hopefully, you know, French journalists can kind of look and be like, okay, what were the lessons that American journalists missed or have learned since that time? And in what ways are we repeating them? How can we responsibly cover Zemmour without doing his job for him?
So one person we've mentioned a bunch of times and you talked a bit about earlier is Marine Le Pen, who used to be sort of the torchbearer of the far right, was the person who made it to the final election tour the last time around. Talk about the impact of all this on her, right? Like, I think the expectation, at least as far as I understood it, was that she would be sort of the predominant far right candidate, that she, you know, had this date with destiny, perhaps with the incumbent president. What has the rise of Zemmour done for her?
So I think what it's done, at least at this early stage, is kind of threatened her position, as you've just laid out, as kind of being the far right ring bearer. You know, when people think far right in France, her family name is kind of almost become synonymous with that, you know, both through her tenure and her father's, and indeed even her niece's, Marion Maréchal Le Pen, who's taken a step back from French politics, but who I think people still kind of think of as, you know, a potential future party leader, someone who I think is probably less committed to the sort of detoxification that her aunt has set out on potentially. But yeah, I mean, so I think Zemmour poses a threat because ultimately, if she were the only option in town, then I think she has more room to try to do that detoxification effort whilst also keeping her, you know, traditional base of supporters, because there's nothing further to the right of her. However, with Zemmour entering the scene, there is suddenly an alternative that is, frankly, you know, probably close to as well known, if not just as well known as she is, who has a following and who crucially is not concerned with detoxifying his image or, you know, trying to make himself more palatable. You know, there's been a lot of talk and analysis about how Zemmour's end goal is to kind of marry the far right and the kind of right in France. And that very well may be the case. It could very much be the case that he has or ends up having supporters who are, you know, potentially Republican supporters and, you know, and then maybe some who were, you know, traditionally Le Pen voters. That's very possible. And I think the risk for Le Pen is that all of, you know, her detoxification efforts end up being for nothing, because Zemmour has come to the scene and has kind of just taken her thunder. And I think in part, in fairness to Le Pen, she is not helped by the fact that we've been here with her before. You know, she made it to the second round. That was a pretty big deal. She was resoundingly defeated in the second round. You know, I remember covering the French election for The Atlantic at that time. You know, that was very much seen as France's kind of, you know, after Brexit, after Trump, this was France's opportunity to kind of, you know, outrightly reject this sort of populist nationalist emergence in their country. So she's been here. People know her. And I think people may potentially think that, well, she had her chance and she was unsuccessful. So there's this new guy in town and he might be more successful. So why don't we support him? And if you're a Le Pen voter who isn't happy with the national rallies, you know, literal name change and, you know, attempts to kind of be more palatable, then he might seem like, you know, perhaps the person to get behind next year.
And is it the case that the overall number of people, this is hard to say for sure, but the overall number of people in France who are inclined to vote for a far-right candidate is more or less stable and they've just shifted predominantly from her to him? Or is it the case that for whatever reason, it's a ever-broadening group of people and you know, he's just siphoning off more of the newcomers?
It's a good question, and I'm not totally sure. I'm not sure if the polling this far out really tells us that much. I mean, I think certainly that there are people who are National Front / National Rally voters who may have been voting for Le Pen for quite some time. You know, she's been a fairly stable presence for many years. Her party, you know, it's even if she has never been able to hold national office, you know, her party are still an established presence, you know, in France at sort of local levels. So, you know, in that respect, I think she does have a base of support. Now, how loyal that base is, I'm not entirely sure. And, you know, it's worth remembering, too, that, you know, it wasn't that long ago that there was another outsider who, well, quote unquote outsider, I think you kind of debate whether he was a complete outsider, who came and disrupted France's political scene. And that was Emmanuel Macron himself. Like, remember that, you know, yes, he did serve in François Hollande's government, but, you know, he kind of came out and formed his own, I want to say party, but remember, En Marche was a movement. So he formed his own movement and kind of came out of nowhere. And he was the sort of centrist candidate. You know, he was able to do that and clearly was able to attract voters from Les Républicains, from Les Socialistes. Like, you know, he was clearly able to attract French voters from other parties. That was the way he got here. So, you know, I think it really is a question of sort of French party loyalty and how much, you know, how fickle those identities can be. But yeah, at the moment, I don't know. It's a really good question. And I think that's something that will certainly Le Pen will be watching. But I think, you know, I imagine journalists like myself will want to be watching closely too.
So one sort of Lawfare specific question and then one general question before we wrap up. So about a year ago, I can't remember the exact date, maybe it was a little bit longer than that, there was the execution, decapitation of a French school teacher, right, on the streets of a suburb outside of Paris. And it garnered a lot of international attention, maybe almost more so for the reaction as opposed to the actual event itself. And bracketing the discussion of whether that was the right way to handle what happened, it did spark this huge debate, both it seems like in France, but also among US journalists about France, about the place of laïcité, the state secularism that you talked about before. And it certainly seemed to have some pretty significant impact on French politics. Do you think it's at all fair to attribute the rise of Zemmour to in any part to after effects of that, or is that sort of just one data point in a larger constellation of things?
I mean, certainly the killing and beheading of Samuel Paty was horrific. And I think that there's the reason it resonated wasn't just because obviously the murder of a teacher just doing his job was just heinous, but I think the manner, of course, in which he was killed was particularly gruesome and upsetting. I don't want to draw too many parallels to it. I mean, could it have been a factor? Maybe. I mean, I think that's probably something that maybe some of my French colleagues would be more well placed to answer. I feel like being here in Britain, it's kind of hard to gauge from afar the impact that's had on sort of the French political conscience. But certainly, you know, I think the fact that happened so recently, and the fact that potential candidates like Zemmour are very much focused on sort of the Islamist threat and, you know, the way in which being like French identity and kind of and immigrants sort of, you know, being part of the country and, you know, all these other themes that he's kind of, you know, he's sort of made his pet issues. I think that the fact that he can kind of just point to that and say, see, this is an issue we need to be talking about right now. This is a matter of, you know, our French security and what it means to be French and laïcité and all those other things. I mean, I could see how he might try to utilize that to talk about these issues. But as for whether that is the reason behind his support, I mean, you know, I think what, and I've said this a couple of times and I'll just keep reiterating it, like we're still so far out. I mean, he's emerged and I have no doubt that we will probably end up talking about him for a long time because I'm not terribly convinced that, you know, he's going to stop being a major presence. But, you know, it's still early days and there's still time to ensure that, you know, I think what will be crucial is that especially once the campaign really gets going, that Eric Zemmour isn't just asked about these issues that he cares about. Like, you know, if he wants to be president of France, he needs to have answers for a whole slew of issues, whether it's, you know, how to continue reckoning with the ongoing pandemic and preventing future pandemics, you know, how to deal with the issues associated with climate change, you know, and then of course all the domestic issues, not to mention sort of foreign policy when it comes to relations with the United States, relations with more broadly with kind of European Union politics. I mean, there are so many issues beyond just this, which of course isn't to say that any are more important than the other, but I think we would be making a big mistake as journalists if we only sort of focused on what Zemmour wants to talk about and not about the litany of other issues that a French president would have to face.
And so quickly to wrap up, you started this by mentioning and reminding us that, one, we're very far out away from the actual election. Two, this is a theoretical presidential candidate who has lots of practical obstacles to him actually winning. So given all of that, I'm curious what you make of the biggest sort of takeaways from the Zemmour experience so far, right? Thinking about him less as, you know, in any sense, a likely actual occupant of the presidential office, but more as like a phenomenon. What do you see as the biggest takeaways from that perspective?
I think what we should always be cognizant of, and certainly I think the lesson that we learned in the United States is that, you know, people love a spectacle. They're attention grabbing. They grab viewers. They drive conversations for days, if not weeks. I remember, because I joined The Atlantic like a few months before the 2016 election, you know, I remember kind of waking up and going to work in the morning and kind of thinking like, oh, well, what is he going to tweet today? Like kind of thinking that, you know, because that was all that, you know, I just remember that being such a sort of conscious thought all the time, because this was a time where it just really felt like Trump, like every day was just saying something new that we had to pay attention to. And I think the biggest lesson is that, like, you know, we know what it means to turn someone into a political spectacle. I think the biggest lesson is probably that, you know, when it comes to dealing with Eric Zemmour, like it is dealing with any other potential candidate for the French presidency, you don't want to make them a spectacle. You want to make them exactly that, a potential candidate, and treat them as such. And then the moment they become a candidate, then you start treating them as a candidate, whether that means affording them more airtime, more closely scrutinizing their sort of policies and promises. And yeah, just, I mean, treating him like every other candidate, because at the moment that really is all he is apart from his views. And that's what distinguishes him. But I think we want to be careful not to signal to audiences and to the French people that he is more deserving of their attention than any of the others, just because he's the loudest, most outrageous voice in the room.
And that is all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Your audio engineer this week is Hamza Chatou of Goat Rodeo, and the podcast is edited and produced by Jen Patia Howell. Your music, as always, is performed by Sophia Yan. If you like the Lawfare Podcast, you may consider checking out our other podcasts in the Lawfare Podcast Network. There's Rational Security, The Report, a narrative podcast series about the Mueller Report, and Lawfare No Bull, a podcast feed in which we clip primary source audio from important events and strip out the grandstanding, the distractions, and leave you with what matters. Thanks, as always, for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.